So, just for an introduction, what I'm going to tell you today is not new research, luckily, because otherwise I would probably be talking about a lot of technical stuff. What I'm talking today is about stuff which already has existed for a couple of years, but which is not very visible. And what I would like is for it to become more visible, because I think that's a good idea in general. And I need to stand really close to them. Can I take it out?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, thank you. Because I like to be more mobile and this and that. So, what we're doing today is crypto recipes if you want to go on a data diet. So, for me, data privacy, privacy in general, but data privacy is not so much something which is added on afterwards. It's more like hygiene. Imagine a surgeon who has done only small operations all his life. He has had no problems because, well, it's even if you don't clean your knife, if you need to cut off a toe or if you need to place a tube in someone's ear, that's easy enough. But suddenly, new innovation enables him to take out someone's colon, someone's naked arm, it's colon. And he uses the same techniques for that. And what happens then? Well, the first patient dies. Not because the colon was not taken out properly, but because of bacterial infection. So he goes back to his other systems. He goes back to the old way. But he wants to try again, and then another one dies. So imagine that surgeon saying, well, all those people die. Maybe I should get insurance or something, because, well, then I can go on, keep going on doing those... Okay. Then I can keep going... Dawe, are you still here? No, Dawe is gone. Dawe knows the password. So if someone could go and get Dawe... Ah, Dawe is here. So Dawe, what is... what is the password, Dawe?
So everybody knows it's Noisy Square with capitals.
That's very few... Okay, so... Okay, it's just the same as the username. Okay, good. So you help me out when I forget. Okay, thank you. So, yeah. So he goes back and he says, well, I want to get insurance on that. And that doesn't make sense because he's not there to cover his own ass. He's there to help his patients. But that is the reality of how data privacy is being approached today. Because what we are doing, the measures we're taking in organizations are not about how to protect our customers, how to protect our civilians, our citizens, but how to protect ourselves. And that doesn't really work. But luckily, in politics, discussion is going on about whether we should improve upon that. And current legislation, I'm sorry, this is very EU-focused, but current legislation in the EU on data privacy is focused on the EU Data Privacy Directive, which stems from 1995. It's the 1946 EC directive, and it leads to national legislation, which in Dutch is the Wet bescherming persoonsgegevens, but every EU country is mandated to have a data protection act. But this act is very limited in what the requirements it puts on your data protection, in the explicit requirements, and also it imposes very limited fines. The fines you will get for breaching someone's data privacy are low at best, even if you already get a fine. So luckily they figured that out, and they're about to change that because that works. They're working on new legislation, and that's the General Data Privacy Regulation. So first there was a directive, now there's a regulation. That's just a big EU law on data privacy. And this is something which will definitely change things. I don't say that it will solve all our privacy concerns, but this will change the game and how it is played. Because it is much more strict, it imposes a lot of requirements on organizations, it's also much more explicit. It says do privacy by design, do privacy by default. And also, it is it imposes much higher fines than before. So we're talking about 2% of your yearly worldwide revenues at maximum. So how large are the biggest corporations in the world? We're talking 500 billion or something. So that's a lot of money. That's over 1 billion. That's money which is normally only paid for antitrust cases right now. And data privacy in the EU will be in the same ballpark with regard to the fines you will be paying. So that is something which drives organizations to change some things. And hopefully to change them for the better, because protecting privacy suddenly starts making good business sense. So who knows? Maybe things will change. But the problem is, we also want to be, well, good businessmen, so we also want to do our job. We can't just throw the processing out as it is done currently. We also want to do our job. And so there's a lot of balancing of interests going on. And sometimes those interests can't be served by being innovative, but sometimes they can. And this talk is about how we can do that. Because you have, certainly you have new questions in our organization. So how do we prevent data leaks? Because it could lead to huge fines. How do we prevent subpoenas? So the request through legal action of certain data. You don't want to give that data away sometimes because it's sensitive for your clients, but also because it's sensitive for your business. And also, if you know that you're storing your data in the cloud, then suddenly you know that the US government may very well be looking on, not just for national security reasons, but maybe even for economic gain. You just don't know what's going on. So in short, the question is, how do we do the same with less data? And then the focus is mostly on personal data. So today I'm going to talk to you about two things you want to achieve. And these two things you can both achieve both through organizational means, that's the classic way, and through cryptographic means, and that is the new way. Now, the advantage of organizational ways, so making sure that the same person can't access both data sets, for example, to bring them together, is that it's relatively cheap to introduce and that you can also change it easily afterwards. But the disadvantage is that you can only have limited trust there. You still have the problems which we saw earlier, for example, if a government accesses the information. So you want, in some cases, to have a higher level of trust to protect those people whose data you're processing in a better way. And that is something you can achieve through cryptographic approaches. So you'd need only very limited trust, but the problem is that there's very little implementations available for some of these techniques. And that's just sad because, well, your buying manager is not going to buy a cryptographic idea. It's going to buy an enterprise data protection package, which you know maybe what's in there, but he doesn't. And if these products are on the market, he will consider them. So there's still a bridge to cross. But I hope that these techniques will become in time more relevant. Let's keep a clock close by so I can see what's going on. Okay, so these two tasks we're going to talk about today. And the first of them is secret sharing. And the second of them is third-party authentication. And we'll tackle them both at one at a time. So let's go first to secret sharing. And secrets here, you must think about them as a password, for example, or a PIN code. And Facebook already does this. Facebook has a way to let you access your account through the attestation of your friends. So you trust your friends, you say to them, well, I want you, and you together to be able to access my account. Not by yourself, but only together. And that's all enforced through some organizational measure. Of course, Facebook is not cryptographically protected on the back end, but so this is just a thought example. But this is the principle we're talking about, to give people access to a certain secret, but only as a group. And this, this you could, for example, do if you're sharing a PIN for an ATM card, we could just have the secret S is 3579. And you want to share it between N participants, so four participants, and only together could they resolve the secret. Well, the trivial way to approach this is to give each participant one digit. So the first share is 3, the second share is 5, the third share is 7, and the fourth share is 9. And so if they want to reconstruct the secret together, they have 3579 because they put the digits they have in the right order, and then they know the secret. So is this secure enough? Well, for that, we need to consider if there's only 3 of them, what do they know? Because 3 is almost 4, but we want them to know nothing. And what happens? So if it's the first, second, and third person together, they know that the PIN code starts with 357. So there's only 10 possibilities left out of the 10,000 which we had in the beginning. So this is not good enough. We want to go to do more. We want to make it more secure. So how do we do that? Well, actually, Adi Shamir, great cryptographer, figured out how to do this quite a while ago, and he made Shamir's secret sharing scheme. I see not some nods from the audience. Very good, very good. Some fans. So what he did was he took a function, a polynomial, so the specific form, and in this case, because we want to have four people together who can reconstruct the secret, he takes one of the 4 - 1 is third degree. And here's the function we're using in this specific example. So the third degree, because there's a 3 here as the highest exponent. So this function is chosen randomly. And that's important to make sure that the secret is the secret is shared in a secure way. But there's one thing not random about this function, and that is the last term, the constant term. That is actually our secret. So the secret is right there. So if we evaluate this function at the x value 0, well, what do we get? We get 0 plus 0 plus 0 plus 3579. So this point is 0, 3, 5, 7, 9. So if you have the function, you can recover the original point. So now what happens to share those, the secret? You evaluate the function not at the point 0, because then you would be giving out the secret, but at 4 other points. And in this case, we use point 1, 2, 3, and 4. So x values 1, 2, 3, and 4. And we calculate what the value is of that function at that spot, and you hand this value out to one of your participants in the scheme. And now, what happens to recover the secret? Well, they need to find a function which goes through these 4 data points, because each and every one of them holds one of the data points, and he can contribute that one and say, here is my contribution, let's find the secret together. And the nice thing is that there is only one solution to that. There's only one polynomial of the third degree which satisfies those 4 data points. So they can figure it out using the Lagrange interpolation theorem, which I'm not going to discuss here, but in a straightforward way to find this function again. And then they know the last term, so they know what the secret was. Now, if there's only 3 of them instead of 4, imagine what would happen. They've got 3 data points, and they want to recover the 4th. Well, can they? Well, again, if we try to apply the Lagrange interpolation theorem, we will find that there's not just one solution, but infinitely many. Infinitely many solutions there are to this problem. And because of that, it's not possible to say which of those infinitely many solutions is the right one. So by having only 3 shares, you have absolutely nothing. So hopefully hopefully the sharing will go right, because if you've shared the secrets correctly, if you've distributed the shares correctly, then you can in this way securely store your secret in a distributed way. So any secret, as I said, is as likely as the next then. So that's secret sharing. So the other part, which we're going to talk about, is third-party authentication. And that is the idea that there's a relying party who wants to know something about you, and there's a testing party. I'm not sure what the SEML term is there, but who are giving out identities, who are saying this is the identity of the person who's trying to authenticate. So in this case, imagine a national ID card. So the national ID card, which I don't have with me, but has all kinds of attributes about me. It has a photograph, it has a first name, a last name, a date of birth, and all these attributes together make up my identity. And normally, if I use it in an offline fashion, I show these attributes and then they can attest with my identity. They want to know something about my identity, and they can see what that something is for me. And they can also see that the card is real. So in the digital scenario, this doesn't work as easily. So our current national ID card in the Netherlands is not yet suitable for these goals, but they're building one. They're designing one to make sure that they can be doing that in an online fashion. And the question is, how would you do that? So imagine a web shop where you, well, web shops want to know your real identity. They want, don't want fraudsters. They want to know that you're over 18 if you're going to an adult web shop. So how can you show your identity without them actually, commit fraud? So the simple approach there is to have a smart card, which is issued by the government, which contains your social security number, digitally signed with a signature from the government, and then if you go to a web shop, you show that social security number, they check the signature, go to the government, and look up your information in the central database. This is not allowed under current Dutch law, which I think is very sensible to not allow that, but this is the most simple way to approach this. If you want to do it in a better way, then you first need to figure out what actually the problem is, because there are some downsides to the simple approach. First, the government finds out every transaction you're doing. They found out to which adult web shop you've been. They found out which information you read using your digital identity. So they find out a lot about you. And that is basically because what you're doing is not really authentication. What you're doing is identification. And after that, based on that, authentication. So maybe we should tone that down a bit. We should only use authentication and not identification if it's not necessary. So the web shop also could replay your digitally signed social security number, so act as if they were you towards some other web shop. And also, maybe if the government just gives everything back to the web shop, they learn more than they should, because maybe they don't even need to know what your last name is or where you live. Maybe they only need to know that you are actually the person you're trying to, you're saying that you are. So basically it boils down to these trust relations. You have you, the government, and the third party. In this case, that's a web shop. And you don't trust the government with the information of what types of transactions you're doing. The government doesn't trust you to be honest about who you are to a web shop. You don't trust the web shop with more information than it actually needs to perform the transaction. Web shop doesn't trust you to be honest about the transaction, about the identity you're attesting to. Government doesn't trust the web shop with more information about their citizens than they need to. And the web shop has limited trust in the government to be honest about my identity. That's a lot of distrust there. And that's fine. Distrust is good in a cryptographic sense because you limit the possibilities for abuse. But we need to reflect that in the approach we're taking. So there's actually a scheme for this, and it's called Uproof. And Microsoft bought it from Credentica, from a Dutch former PhD student, Stefan Brands, who invented it. It's always hard if mathematics is invented or discovered, but who invented it and then sold it to them. And it's an open technology in the sense that you can all take the specification and implement it yourself. Microsoft is not going to sue you, which is good. Microsoft is really making strides forward there, I think. And so what happens there is that you still have the smart card, but what you do is you create tokens about yourself. And the government checks that the values in those tokens are valid, but it doesn't see the entire token. So it doesn't see the actual public key in the token, a little bit specific, but it can check that your name is valid, your date of birth is valid, your photograph in there is valid. And in that way, it can make sure that it only signs valid tokens. So you get a bunch of tokens from the government, and that's just a data packet which has a signature of the government, the data attributes of you, and the public key. So the technical specifics, I'm not going in there too deeply because they're actually quite complex, but you get that. And then you can use those tokens from your smart card to authenticate, not identify yourself, but authenticate to a web shop. I want to show that I'm over 18 at my web shop. I use my token. It's like a burqa, actually. You put it over your identity card, and there's only a small slit where your date of birth is. Because all the other things, they don't need to know. They don't need to know what your name is to check whether you're over 18. And in that way, you can shop in a way where the shop gets only the information they need, and the government is in no way informed of what you're doing, because the shop is not contacting the government to verify that information. They can check the signature which was put on there. So that's a nice technique, but there's two difficult words here, and that's the blindly here and the blindly there. So you're doing stuff there where you prove something, but you're not really sure, you're not even sure what you're signing as the government. So is that even possible? And the concept of behind that is a zero knowledge proof. So a zero knowledge proof, also we're not going to dive into the technical details, but it's at the core of many privacy preserving cryptographic techniques. And it is all about showing one thing, that you're able to do one thing, that you know one thing, without without giving out any knowledge about the thing you're proving, other than the fact that it is in fact true. So there's actually a very nice example of a zero knowledge proof, and that's centered around the concept of Where is Waldo, a familiar game, I think, for all of you. Very briefly, for those of you who don't know it, you've got a big drawing of a lot going on, and then somewhere in the corner is Waldo, and you need to find him. So you're checking where Waldo is, and then suddenly you find him. That's the game. So there was research done on this game, on a certain game you could put on that. So imagine you're sitting there with a friend of yours, and you and your friend are both looking for Waldo on the same drawing. Now, your friend tells you, "I found him. I found Waldo." The problem now is, where is Waldo, of course, but also how do you know for sure that your friend found him without knowing where he actually is? So how do you do that? Well, there was actually research done by three researchers, or actually two researchers and the little daughter of one of the researchers, to find a technique on how to do this. So how do you do this? You want to show I know where Waldo is without actually revealing where he is. And the technique they came up with is basically to take a very large sheet of paper and have the person who is going to be convinced leave the room for a while, put the sheet of paper over the drawing in some way, we don't reveal the orientation, and then the other person comes back. So this is our setup. And the other person only sees a sheet of paper. He doesn't really know what's under it. Well, he expects it, that it's the drawing, but he doesn't know for sure. And he also still doesn't know where Waldo is. So then the other person who just came back can choose. Does he want to know for sure that the drawing was beneath that? I'll unlock it in a minute. Does he want to know for sure that the drawing was underneath there? Or does he want to know for sure that you know where Waldo is? Those are both relevant things to show, of course, if you want to prove that you know where Waldo is. So if he chooses the first thing, uncover, then the prover uncovers the drawing and he can see that, well, there's the drawing. That's not the complex part. In the other case, if you want to show that you know where Waldo is, he says, make a hole. So you make a hole exactly at the point where you know Waldo is. And the other person sees, well, yeah, Waldo is beneath there. But of course, then we can't uncover anymore because you would disclose where Waldo just was. So you prove that you know where Waldo was without showing where he actually is. And the question then becomes, well, how easily can you cheat? And the answer is 50%. If you know that the other person is going to say, I want you to uncover, you don't even need to know where Waldo is. So you uncover and show the drawing again. If the person on the other side is... thank you. Thank you, Oscar. So if the other person on the other side is going to say make a hole, then you just put another drawing under there of Waldo, one for where you know where Waldo is, because maybe you made it yourself, and then you can make a hole, because you don't need to probe where the entire drawing is. So by iterating this process, you can actually give arbitrary certainty to the other person that you actually are not cheating and that you actually know what is going on. Because if you can do this 10 times in a row correctly, then there's a possibility of a half to cheat every time, to the power of 10, so that's a power a possibility of about 1 in 1,000 that you cheated. So then I would be convinced. So this is the basic idea behind a zero-knowledge proof. I commit to a certain setup, you pose a challenge to me, and I show that I can do the challenge. So with a token, it's the same thing. I commit to a certain setup, you say, well, show me that the attributes are right, or you say, show me the public key, and then you can... Well, okay, I'll just unlock it when I need to go on, but thank you, Oscar. Or show me the public key, and then it's being signed. By arbitrarily giving more and more certainty, you can actually convince the government that he can go on and sign the key. One second. That worked. Okay, so zero-knowledge proofs are at the core of many privacy-preserving techniques. And they are also important in other situations where you can imagine that you would like to have such a privacy-preserving property. So in auction, you don't want to show what the entire bidding strategy was. You only want to show your bid and your identity if you actually won the auction. So that's very limited information. Conditionally given, but using zero knowledge proofs, you can achieve that in the same way. Bitcoins, familiar to all, I expect, are also using such techniques to show that you have actually performed a certain calculation in a certain way without showing the entire calculation, because then you would lose your position, namely your Bitcoin. And basically, well, what all of this boils down to is that if you want to achieve better privacy for your customers, better privacy for your citizens, go ask your friendly cryptographer, because he may know stuff which enables you to preserve privacy better, which he hasn't even told you, because maybe he thinks you're not interested, or maybe he thinks it won't work. But by working together, we can implement such and other techniques to make sure that privacy is preserved in a better way. Maybe I'm just too hopeful, but I think the alternative is even worse, so let's work together and make something great out of it. Thank you very much. So I'm not really sure where Douwe is now, but if there's any questions from the Douwe is here. Yeah, Douwe, sorry, I finished a bit early, so.
Mic here. We can put the sound on.
Sorry, man. Okay, no problem.
First question.
Yes.
Okay.
No, but everyone can hear then.
You said there's a probability of 50% that you can cheat.
Mm-hmm.
So how large should N regularly be? Many iterations.
How
many?
It depends on the context, of course. So if you are playing with your friend, then I think N is 10 equals 10 should be sufficient. If you are playing with the government to prove that your token is actually valid, I think it should be a lot larger. So by iterating then, say, 40, 50 times, you can achieve such great precision that it's very hard to actually cheat.
Any other questions? Oscar?
Have you seen or used the Shamir's secret sharing scheme?
In practice, you mean?
Yeah.
If I've seen it used, or if I've used it myself?
Both.
I've seen it once, namely used by myself. My friends really didn't understand what was going on, so I gave them their share, and they were like, okay. I've never really reconstructed the shares. I'm afraid that no real implementations are there to easily use it. But it does work.
Okay, because I know where it is used.
Tell me.
It's used for about 5 years in a biomedical application, a scientific research application in France. And I've helped a bit in coding and also resolved. And actually, some of the code was on CERN's CVS systems. And I kind of salvaged it before that one went down. Because they moved to SVN and the code would be down.
Oh.
So it's on my GitHub now.
Nice.
So
So there's an actual implementation using
yeah,
it.
Yeah, and it's fully usable as a library, and it uses the joining, the splitting, but also the partial splitting. So you can say, I have five key pieces to share, and I only need three to reconstruct the original key. And the motivation was to encode DICOM files, so these are the files outputted by MRI scanners mm-hmm. and so on, anonymize them, but still you have the EU laws basically that this is biological material encoded digitally, so you have all kinds of funny laws. So the thing they kind of did is kind of hacked it. They all the headers from the DICOM files were removed, but still they encrypted it, because I don't know if you've ever seen a DICOM file from an MRI scanner. There's a nice cheat from a professor. If they don't know who's the guy in the hallway or the next one up front, and they want to check the DICOM file, they just do a, you know, it's all slices, right?
Yeah.
So they do really in the 3D imaging, they do really fast back and forth slider.
So you just see the
face.
Of
you
the
can
body.
Reconstruct the face, and you can say, okay, that's the patient in the room, right? So this is the silly
you
hack.
You actually
on that.
Do that?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, so nice. This is the fun. It's a bit of a funny thing to do and see. Actually, you need a fast computer.
Yeah.
But the thing is, they do, for instance, vein and fluid dynamic checks on grid clusters and compute mm-hmm. clusters. And yeah. Hey, that's part of my old business. The files were encrypted with an AES key, but they don't want to have one key server to uphold all the keys for all the patients for everything.
Mm-hmm.
So they split it over three key servers, and you need to hack three different key servers before you can actually reconstruct the key to process the file on some whatever cluster in a hospital.
That sounds
or
really
a remote
cool.
site. And this was one of the applications, and I think this is can also be used in, I don't know, I had the wild idea for MP-OTR, for instance, to be able to use this kind of encryption to share stuff among mm-hmm. all the participants.
There's actually a discussion on MPOTR tomorrow at 12 in this tent. So
oh, very nice.
You might want to join that.
Yeah, thank you very much.
So are there any more questions or great applications that people want to share? Not so much.
Okay, thank you
well
very
then,
much.
Thank you very much, and sorry for the technical difficulties. Give him a big round of applause. And probably you'll be around, so people can ask you more questions.
Yeah, I'll be around this tent for about 10 more minutes if people are looking for me, and otherwise I'm just on the T field next to the T3 tent, so should be okay there as well.
Cool. Thank you very much.